Hey everyone, welcome to the 365th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And I'm just going to let you know that I am reporting from the field at the TinyML conference here in San Francisco, and that's why I might sound a little weird. And if you want to find out what I've learned at this event, you're going to want to subscribe to the newsletter, if you're into TinyML.
You sound California-ish.
Do I sound California-ish? That's exactly where I am. So no more y'alls for this podcast. I don't even think I could do that. Do you think I could do it, Kevin?
No, I don't think you could.
He's like, I want to give you the credit, but no, Stacey, it's impossible.
I really do. I really do, but I don't think it's possible.
All right. I was going to say, y'all should listen for y'alls. Oh, it's too late. Okay. So let me tell you what kind of show we have today. It's going to be awesome. We're going to be talking about Helium. It got funding and it's rebranding. So you'll find out its new name in a second. We've got some really cool privacy research about hiding your identity from video cameras. We're going to be talking about bees and smart beehives because that is a buzzing industry. We've also got a little segment that I think of as our dystopian world. We're going to be talking about a startup called Caterpillar. You'll find out about them. There's also a new lock combined with a camera from Eufy. We've got Arduino as a new board. We've got a new hack for Wyze Cam users and a hack for uninterruptible power supplies. And in the not hacking category, we've got some news from Google. Plus, we're going to hear from Save Our Standards, which is our sponsor. And our guest this week is Doug Stovall, who is the CEO of ASSIA. We're going to be talking about ASSIA's wireless power option that doesn't require you to have a pad. So we're going to talk about that coming into smart home devices next year. It's going to be an awesome show. But first, let's hear from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Rack Wireless. Mark your calendars and join Rack Wireless at their spring launch on April 7th. You're going to be surprised with every possibility that unveils their new hardware products and software tools to create, compile, debug, and manage your IoT projects easily. Follow Rack Wireless on their social media and discover how they empower us innovators and creators to make IoT our own with all of their new products. That's April 7th. Check it out. Alrighty, Kevin. Let's hit our big story, which is Helium, which is no longer Helium. What's happening?
Yeah, so two things are happening. Helium, as you said, is no longer Helium. It is rebranding to Nova Labs. And the new Nova Labs has raised another $200 million in Series D funding. And the valuation now of the Helium / Nova Labs network company is $1.2
billion. $1.2
billion.
I'm sorry. Well, that's a lot. I think it's warranted, except, and this is where things get kind of weird. So Helium, if you're not aware, we talk about them all the time. Now Nova Labs, so we'll start calling them Nova Labs. They don't produce anything.
They're implementing a decentralized LoRaWAN network.
Yes, a decentralized peer-to-peer LoRaWAN network where people get Helium hotspots and they prove and they attach them to their Wi-Fi network. These hotspots then generate a LoRaWAN signal and then it uses whoever the consumer's backhaul is to get to the internet. I run a Helium hotspot. It's super fun. When you have one, you get, you generate tokens, Helium network tokens, and that is for providing proof of network coverage, basically, instead of proof of work like you might on the blockchain. So there's.
You also get that for network usage, though. I don't think you get as much.
Yes, you get HMTs for network usage. And Helium or Nova sells data credits and data credit, you exchange your H&T for data credits, and that's for companies that want to buy access to the Helium network. So if I'm a company that makes sensors and I want to have a LoRaWAN sensor that's always connected, I will pay Nova Labs for data credits, and then I will use those up with my sensor traveling around the network. And it's very cheap and it's a great idea, but it's a very convoluted setup. And I was just trying to seek clarity when I reached out to Helium about this news. And I was like, hey, by the way, can we run down how Nova Labs is going to make money on this? Because my understanding is they have a chunk of HNTs that is, you know, subject to the market whims, as it were. But then they also have, I don't know.
Yeah, honestly, it's kind of hard to figure out. And I put my, I don't want to say crypto hat on, but crypto token hat on last night and looked into this. I'm not sure that people actually buy data credits for cash. And I say that because...
Oh, no, you need to buy data credits using HNT. So you have to buy HNT.
Right.
That's what generates the value for HNTs.
Right, okay. I wasn't sure if that was clear to people.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
So there's no actual fiat currency purchasing here. It's you're buying a crypto token called Helium Network Token or HNT. The price fluctuates, etc. And then you convert the HNT to data credits, and that HNT token is burned. It basically will no longer appear in the circulating supply of tokens. And that, theoretically, as more people use the network, could increase the price because there's less supply of the tokens. That's a whole other aspect that really doesn't answer the question, how does Nova Labs make money? And the only thing I can come up with so far, because they weren't willing to share any information at this time when Stacey asked them, was that the token allocation, actually 35% of it goes to the company and its investors. Now, that allocation percentage decreases over time, but they still always get some of the allocations. So maybe they're selling them themselves on the market because, I mean...
But that's not a sustainable business model, though.
No, it's not. That's what... raise the red flag to me.
Yeah.
So there has to be something more. Unless the investors, obviously investors will have different information than we, the public, have. So maybe there is a plan that we're not aware of. The only other thing I can think of if you're an investor is that the growth rate has been phenomenal. They've gone from 14,000 hotspots last year to, they're aiming for 1 million by the end of this year. And they've had over 4,000% growth rate in hotspots last year deployed. There's a wait list of 3.5 million hotspot owners, including me. I'm on that list. So maybe it's like build it out now and monetize later, which we see often. I don't think it's going to work in this space, but
that is a viable strategy, especially one that venture capitalists like. I was just going to let you know that there are now, as of Wednesday morning, 683,145 hotspots available, which is a lot. And we also learned that Helium actually has a lot of customers now, including big companies like Cisco. And I can't remember the others.
Oh, Schneider Electric, Accenture, Careband, Victor, Oopo, which I've never heard of. But hey, I'm sure it's a great company. Yeah, there's a bunch. And actually, Goodyear is looking at going onto the network. And maybe they're going to track tires and things. I have no idea.
Sensors that track tire pressure and report back would be kind of interesting. I'm not going to lie. Although, unless it said you can't start your car unless your tires have air. I don't know. Anyway, okay. That's enough about Helium. Let's talk about a privacy-protecting research project from MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory.
CSAIL.
Yeah, we talk about them all the time. They're doing some really cool work. They've designed something called Privid, and it is adding differential privacy to video images to protect people from, so someone can't go back and look at a camera image and decide if you were there or not at a period in time. Now, again, this is just research. The fear that this is answering is, I don't, we've all read the like books where the FBI like takes over cameras or looks over public street cams looking for a person. And you think about like with Clearview AI, is it possible yet? It would take so much computing power, it's probably not worth it. But we're getting there. And then they could be like, oh, there's Stacy. She's in this place right now, on the run from the law.
I presume that this would only apply to like actual AI ML sifting through the video?
Yes, it is not humans.
Yeah. So if like if I had all the video feeds, which would be crazy, and I had to look through something, that's way too time consuming to be effective. But I could theoretically do that. It's not going to totally protect you from that anyway.
Well, that yes, that is true. If you've got a really dedicated, this is like a Silence of the Lambs situation and you've got a dedicated profile hunter, yes, this is not going to prevent you from that. But what they've done is they've done something called differential privacy. You may remember differential privacy because Apple implemented it. It's a statistical technique, and basically it lets you add random noise to prevent re-identification of whatever. Exactly. So if you were listening to this podcast, you might not be able to identify Kevin because of the weird noises he's making. No, that's a joke. So the idea is you add this noise to the data, and then it protects people from being identified, but you can still do things like count the number of people at an intersection or doing things like that. So you would have to like kind of randomize the entire video, but it would still be useful. So I like it. I think this sort of thing should be regulated, should be implemented as a regular feature. I mean, I just think about things like license plate scanning and how like homeowners associations are using that. And police are now using that to pull like to find out where people were at specific times.
If it was mandated, it would certainly go a long way towards easing people's privacy concerns. But I have a feeling that the powers that be don't want it mandated because they'll want to see certain people at certain places to track individuals.
That's frustrating because I think if you could unlock it with a warrant, that would be appropriate, right? So you mandate it's closed and unlock it with a warrant. That feels legit. But otherwise, I don't like it.
Sure. Then go back and remove the randomness. And
Yeah. Because that prevents you from like the scary ex-boyfriend problem is how I think of it, which is like, let's say you have an ex on the police force looking at things. Anyway, okay. So that exists. Will we see it in cameras? Probably not, but wouldn't it be neat? It's available. There are options available. So, it's a thing that can happen.
And the technique is used today. I believe Apple's been using it for several years.
Yes, they have. Differential privacy is totally a thing that is in use today. Okay, let's talk about robotic beehives. Mostly because a company called BeeWise just announced an $80 million Series C funding. And because I happen to be at this conference that's all about tiny ML, tiny machine learning on devices. And one of the really compelling use cases I saw was two separate use cases involving monitoring beehives. And beehives are like, I was going to say, they're the worker bees of the farm world. Lord.
Well, the planet.
They pollinate a lot of our crops.
Yeah.
The planet,
yeah. No, they are. I mean, there are lots of concerns that the bees are, the population is decreasing, and that hurts plant pollinization and many other things that impact the ecosystem. So, yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah. I mean, like people literally rent and bring their beehives out to farms. They set them up, and their beehives, like the bees go out and they pollinate for like a week, and then the people pack their beehives up in their trucks and move on. Like this is a business.
It's like a bee retreat.
It's like, except they've got to work the whole time. Ah, anyway. So BeeWise is doing a full on hive robot. We also like when I was watching the presentation, I saw beehives in Kenya and they were actually just using, it was a Sigfox network, believe it or not. So they were using local machine learning to check for temperature, all the things for a healthy hive, basically, and reporting that data back. It was also to prevent beehive thefts, which are a thing there. And then another company I talked to was offering machine, like computer vision. You place a camera at the hive entrance and it looks for the mite that people think is associated with colony collapse disorder. Mm. So as bees enter into the hives, there's this camera that's looking specifically for, it starts with a V and I can't think of it, this particular mite that causes, that actually science thinks causes colony collapse disorder. And if it finds it, it notifies you and you can quarantine that hive. So that's three smart beehive options out there. I think there's a lot of ways to protect bees. We just have to implement them.
And there is some money in smart beehives because the BeeWise costs $400 a month and an initial $2,000 delivery setup.
Wow is right.
Wow.
Those are some fancy stuffs. But there's lots of options. And if you're on the lower end, maybe you follow the just monitoring your beehives. That's a thing that you can do.
Yeah. I mean, this is for 24 colonies. So you got to be a serious bee person. I don't know.
I think it's an apiarist.
That could be.
We'll see.
Like, if you say
all
so.
All right. There we go. Let's move on to the, we live in a dystopia now section of the show. I really think I should start a podcast called Our Dystopian World, where I just highlight things like this. So there's a startup, and Kevin doesn't agree that this is dystopian, so we're going to have a little argument
yet.
Here. Get ready. Mom and Dad are fighting. All right. A startup called Caterpillar has received £450,000 for a rewards program for activity trackers in health. So this is an app that rewards users for eating well and doing exercise, and you can exchange those points for discounts at a local cinema or an online gym class or whatever. And it's going to connect to, it's a software app that connects to like your Google Fit or Apple Health programs, and you automatically get your points. You don't have to input anything in. And the idea is that healthy behavior leads to exciting rewards.
So I understand the fear of programs such as these. However, on the flip side, I participate in one of these similar programs. I do it through my health insurance provider, which is CVS here in the US. And they have actually multiple rewards programs, but one of them, I can earn up to $300 per year if I link my Apple Health account using an Apple Watch with their app. And it does the exact same thing as what Caterpillar is doing. And I've actually, because of those incentives, that cash reward, I've been walking more. I've been trying to get my daily steps in and meet the goals to earn up to $300 a year. So it's helped me physically. And again, it may help me financially, not in a huge way. But so I see the benefit of it. Plus, it's an insurance company, so they're probably gathering the data for insurance purposes. And
well, and if you're healthier, they don't have to pay for your
exactly
claims, unless you break something on your walk. I mean,
well, yeah.
There's always that.
Yeah. So I would be more worried if you saw like Amazon Halo do something where they're like, hey, we'll give you Amazon Prime free for a year if you share all of this health data with us, and they expand the amount of data and give incentives like that. Because that's the bigger...
It's a bigger company?
Elephant in the room to me.
Okay, so I see two issues here with this. One is right now these are incentives. Could they ever turn to penalties?
Mm.
Is the lack of an incentive a penalty? The other is that by establishing penalties for health, is that coercive? So on the first part, you know, you've got to think about, well, what if you're not able to, like, do they have metrics in place for people who are not able to eat the typical diet or who are not able to exercise in a way that might be tracked by this? Like, if you can't take steps because you're in a wheelchair,
right,
what are the options available to you then? And then on the coercive side, if you are poor, some of mm-hmm. these might feel like, right now, going to the cinema is not a thing, right? So there's always the question when you set these incentives in place, do you ultimately reward people who have more time and freedom and energy to continue accruing rewards, right? So,
or are you penalizing the people who just can't do it, which whatever segment of the population doesn't have the device to track it or doesn't have an iPhone to use, Apple Health, et cetera. I get that. Yes.
And it's really hard. I mean, there's a whole series of psychology and possibly economics dedicated to like nudging people into the right direction. And if you get enough people, that could actually free up money and care for people who need it, who can't do these things, I guess. But ultimately, these are the questions I want us to ask when we encounter these things. And I agree with you. If Amazon, that feels coercive almost because it's hard to live without Amazon Prime for some people. And how much data would they want and what would they do with it? It doesn't matter. Give them my data so I can have cheap Prime. And people, we really do underestimate the value of our data, or we overestimate it in a monetary perspective, but we underestimate what companies can learn from us and how they can then use dark patterns against us to sell us things and that sort. So, and that's our dystopian world. Let's talk about cameras, specifically cameras on door locks. What?
Yeah, this is interesting. I know we shared the news in your newsletter earlier this month, but we didn't talk about it on the podcast, and there are also more details available now. Eufy, which we've talked about their devices in the past, and then I think they make pretty solid devices.
I just bought a Eufy smart lock.
You should have just bought this one. Well, though you won't have it.
It's like, this was an emergency lock situation, but yes.
Yeah, okay. So if you need a lock fast, this is not the lock for you, because Eufy turned to Kickstarter. And they have raised, as of right now, $1.1 million of the svelte $50,000 goal. This is the See Everything Smart Lock. And I really like this because it integrates the camera and the lock all in one. Because I don't like the look of having a separate video doorbell camera thingy and a smart lock in my house. So this has lock, has a camera. You'll get, you'll know when visitors approach. You'll get lock and unlock notifications. It has a built-in fingerprint reader, which is nice to get in. It also has a keypad built in. So it's kind of got a little bit of everything. It's going to retail for $399, which sounds like a lot. But if you, well, it is a lot, I guess. But however, there are current available pledges on Kickstarter that you can get this for $269 right now. I mean, it's got a doorbell chime. It's an all-in-one. I mean, and they say it's, well, estimated delivery is May, so it's not too far out.
All right. Maybe we should pick one up. I'm very curious to see how people interact with it, because one, if you're going to eliminate your doorbell and you turn it into your lock, you have to train people to poke the doorbell that's now your lock, which is a little weird.
I mean, there's a big old button on the front of it at the bottom under the keypad with a doorbell icon.
Oh, no, I see that. But I'm also like, I mean, I still have, like, when I go to someone's house, for example, and they have a Ring, but they still have their old doorbell somewhere else, or if they have any sort of connected doorbell, my finger automatically goes to the other doorbell. And I'm like, no, it's this one. And that's actually not an uncommon setup. So unless you eliminate, and if you eliminate the doorbell entirely, I don't know if people will just think to look there, right? I mean, I don't think,
I mean, if
you're looking for
it, the only thing on the door. It's the only thing on the door.
On autopilot.
I think it'll be okay. I don't know.
It's, you know what it's I fair. Think? I think we should buy it. We should also set up a separate cam and see how confused people get walking up to the door. That would be a fun project.
Oh, that's just harsh.
No, not in a mean way. It's just to see. I'm not trying to prank people. I'm just like,
yeah, but think of the videos we'll capture of them scratching their heads going, what the heck? What do I do?
Oh, we'd have to run after them and get permission.
That's okay. True. Well, hey, there's no subscription fee for this, which is interesting because it does come with some built-in AI and person notification.
So you know they're coming and you could be like, the doorbell is the lock. Okay, I'll stop talking on this. What else does this? Does this have two-way audio? I can talk to them?
I believe it does. I mean, they're showing pictures of the app, and the app has a little microphone button there. It's not really specified in the specs, but...
Okay, and it would solve... So we just put up the Wi-Fi Eufy lock in our house, and it would solve an issue that we had. It has a fingerprint scanner, which is kind of fun. In our situation with the lock, the fingerprint has a hard time getting read completely because of the door jam. Like putting your finger up against the door jam, it just takes a smidgen extra. It's not as easy, right? So in this situation, it would be in a new location and you touch the top of the lock to unlock it. So that might be nice. And I think I did my thumb because I'm an idiot. So I think doing my index finger would also help.
You might want to change that.
Yeah.
I can personally tell you that while I might test this, I would not personally buy one.
¿Por qué no?
It is not HomeKit compatible.
Oh, yeah. Ce n'est pas HomeKit compatible. All right. I don't know why we went into...
Different languages. Yeah. Random noise.
Exactly. That was our differential privacy for the week. All right. So if you want, this is on Kickstarter. It's delivery in May. You can get it for cheaper. Yay. Other new things. Last week, but after we published the podcast, Arduino actually launched something called the Pro Portenta X8. And this is a massive Arduino board that runs Linux. And we had hinted that Arduino was going to put Linux on something eventually. And this is that board. This board has the MCUs, and it also has a quad-core ARM Cortex-A53, which is a beefy old processor. So this is for industrial use.
Compared to older Arduinos.
Yes. Now, this is not the first, I shouldn't say it's the first Arduino to run Linux, because, man, I think in like 2014, they announced something called the Yun, which had a combo of microprocessors and Cortex processor on it. But this is more tightly integrated and all-in-one. So it's a little bit friendlier, maybe, is the way to think about.
Yeah. I mean, this is more to compete with at a low level, like a Raspberry Pi. It's smaller than one, but it has a lot of similarities and capabilities.
I reached out to some people. I wrote about it just as like, hey, this is, and I thought it was worth writing about too, because they did a deal with a company called Foundries.io. And in that deal, Foundries offers it's basically a dynamic security model in the sense that you can run, it's a cloud-based and device-based security platform that lets you do, you know, continuous integration, continuous delivery, rolling back and forth patches, all that sort of thing. It lets you have over-the-air updates and some authentication stuff. And the nice thing is they're supporting it for this device for as long as you want to use this device. So there's not like a 7-year limit on updates. So I like that because it ties security to a platform that is independent of the hardware platform, which I think will be important for IoT security, because then you have the security for the life of however long that device is going to run.
Now, I mean, we've talked about Raspberry Pis quite a bit, and we're going to talk about Home Assistant later in the show, but I'm thinking theoretically you could use one of these for Home Assistant, which was never possible on anything Arduino
in the past. That's true. Now, I will say I reached out to a friend of mine, Jonathan Berry, who is the CEO of a company called Goliath. He's a hardware engineer he used to work at Nest, and he's my go-to guy for weird platform questions. And I asked him about this. He's like, you know, it's really unclear who the target buyer for this would be. He's like, 9 cores is nice, but most developers have trouble managing 2. So he was like, it feels a bit like the Hermes Apple Watch. There are buyers for such a premium device, albeit limited, but the value is that it just exists and makes a statement in the world.
And it is a premium device when you look at the price. And I don't know if the chip supply issue is having playing a part on the price. I was shocked when I saw it says sold out on their store right now, but that's because it's not even available till mid-April. So it's technically not sold out. It's just never been sold yet. It'll be sold in a couple of weeks. I would have guessed $100 for this, but it's $239.
Wow, that's like more than a Jetson, I think. A low-end Jetson. That's fancy. All right, well, hey, premium. All right, so that's the Arduino Pro Portenta X8. Let's talk about hacking, since we just talked about a little bit of security. We've got a new hack out there. The Wisecam has a flaw that lets hackers remotely access your saved videos.
So the funny thing is, this is actually an old hack. There was a bug that was reported to Wise back in 2019, and Wise has fixed some of the threat vectors, but they only just recently fixed, 3 years later, this particular issue, which is SD card access. And that's crazy to me because, like, again, I keep coming back to the selling point for people who want privacy. Well, go with Wise if you don't want your video stored in the cloud, because you can store it locally on the SD card, and you and only you have that SD card. But this issue has been around for the better part of 3 years.
All right. So they fixed it?
They fixed it in January 29th of this year with a firmware update.
Okay. Well, good. We'll update your Wise cams, y'all. All right.
By the way, if you have a Wisecam version 1, you don't get the update. You have to have a version 2 or 3.
Oh, they stopped supporting it. Yeah. That makes sense. Okay, and another hacking issue. Hackers are gaining access to your uninterruptible power supplies. How, Kevin?
Oh, let's see. It's a very challenging hack. It's because people are using unchanged default usernames and passwords. Who would have thunk it?
All of us. So yeah. Use different passwords. Use a password manager. Change your default password. These are all good.
Or don't have an internet-connected UPS.
Or that, yes. If it's internet connected, you got to think security. All right. Moving on. And final story of the week is Google is building Bluetooth tracker detection directly into Android. And why is this important, Kevin?
Well, because they don't have it now, and Apple does, quite honestly. Apple has their AirTags, the Find My Network. They've had some privacy issues with people being tracked through AirTags being stashed on them, their car, their bag. So it looks like Google is working on integrating this into Android, adding some security to detect trackers that maybe you haven't authorized. And I wonder if they're going to add this to their own network of finding devices, because you can track your Android phone or your Chromebook or whatever with Google now, but I don't think you can do it with like tile trackers and other things. So I wonder if they're beefing up their version of the Find My Network with this.
That would be nice. Or, you know, being able to, I know that Apple makes an app that's not great for Android for detecting things, but it would be great if we had interoperability across all layers of this particular system. Yes.
I would agree.
Anyway. All right. Moving right along. Now it is time for the Internet of Things podcast hotline, the segment of the show where we listen to you and answer your questions about, well, anything you care to ask us. The IoT Podcast Hotline is brought to you by Schlage. Schlage's innovative door hardware is made for modern life. With smart locks that integrate with Apple HomeKit, Amazon Alexa, Ring, and more, it's easy to see why smarter homes start with Schlage. Find the right lock for your smart home at schlage.com. And this week, if you call, actually, well, for the rest of Thursday, so if you listen to this on Thursday, which is March 31st, and call us at 512-623-7424, you will be entered to win a Schlage lock. So, yay! And if you enter after that, you will be entered to win our April prize, which we haven't set yet, so you'll have to listen next week for that. Okay, you'd have to listen to next week anyway, because you'd have to see if you won. All right. This week on the hotline, we have a message from Justin, and we're a little confused, Justin, about what you want. Let's hear it.
Hi, this is Justin from Hannibal. I use Home Assistant, and I love it. It's a lot of fun. However, I experiment with lots of things, and when I used in conjunction with Amazon, I end up with lots of devices that are, that no longer exist. Is there a way to quickly remove all devices that haven't connected in a while? Thanks.
Justin, it's unclear if you wanted to delete all of your devices from Madam A or from Home Assistant. So we figured out how to do it both ways. One way is far easier. All right. I hate deleting devices from my Madam A app, and I actually learned something in doing this, because when I go, my Madam A app runs incredibly slow. It's just so epically awful. But if you have only a few devices to delete, just open your Madam A app, go to devices, go to all devices, and then you're going to see all of your devices. Then you just select it and tap the settings icon and delete it. It's a trash can icon or a trash can. But if you've got a whole bunch of them, because if I try to do that, it takes forever, you can actually use the web-based interface at, I'm just going to say it, alexa.amazon.com. You'll log into that as you, and then you can actually just go through and hit forget on all the device listings that you have. You have to go into your web portal for Madam A, click Smart Home on the side menu, click on Devices. You'll see all the devices and just go and delete all of them. Now, if that does not answer your question and you were actually looking for Home Assistant help, Kevin's gotcha.
Right. And we mentioned this because there have been many reports of people that have what I'll call phantom devices in Home Assistant, even after they've removed the devices from the respective smart device app, such as Madam A. It's very strange, and I don't know if it's because of the integrations or what, but it doesn't matter what the reason is. If you have Madam A supported devices in Home Assistant after you've deleted them from the Madam A app, what you can do, I mean, you can go in there and individually delete them through the graphical user interface, but you just choose the device, right click, and you'll have a delete option. However, some people said, I don't have a delete option. if you experience this, that suggests to me that the registry or the database that Home Assistant is using is not quite right. You can manually, and you got to know a little bit of Linux to do this, you can manually go into the entity underscore registry on the SD card. It's listed in the core folder of Home Assistant, and you can see all the devices. They're called entities in Linux, but you can modify that text file. I would probably back it up first, then modify, try one device, remove it, see what happens, see if it disappears. And if you really want to get fancy, we can put a link in the show notes for basically a query that says select all devices that are Madame A devices, and it will delete all of them from your registry because you were looking for a way to do this all at once. I would start with just modifying the text file personally if this is what you need to do and you can't do it through the GUI. But in any case, we'll have that link in the show notes and you can do the manual registry modifications.
Excellent. All right. Well, Justin, thanks for calling in. Hopefully we will help you. And for everyone else, you can give us a call at 512-623-7424. And if you call before March 31st, midnight Eastern, you will be entered to win a Schlage Glock. Call after that, you'll be entered in to win whatever our April drawing is. That concludes this segment of the show, but please stay tuned for our guest, Doug Stovall, who is the CEO of ASSIA, and we are going to be talking about the delivery of wireless power to wearables and smart home devices. But first, a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Save Our Standards.
Hey everyone, we are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. And this week's sponsor is Save Our Standards. Save Our Standards brings together a cross-section of industries to advocate for a fair and transparent licensing system for standard essential patents. And I have Kent Baker here, who is head of IP strategy, litigation, and licensing at uBlox. Hi Kent, how are you today?
Very well, thanks Stacey.
Excellent. So, what is uBlox and why are y'all a member of Save Our Standards?
At uBlox, we create the wireless modules and semiconductors used by a wide variety of things that range from automobiles to IoT, and you'll recognize them because they show up in consumer products. We joined SOS as a charter member because we file patents, and we also license many of the standard essential patents needed to make these products. So you can see why we have a vested interest in policies and practices involving standard essential patent licensing.
So Kent, I understand that you are a veteran of the standard essential patent licensing world for wireless communications. From your experience, what do IoT hardware makers need to keep in mind?
You're dating me now, Stacey, because I have been around a while. I think it's important to remember that licensing standard essential patents, or SEPs for short, has a larger impact on the economy than you may think. Aggressive SEP holders can use the threat of product bans or costly legal battles to end another company's IoT product development, or even force that company to abandon the market entirely. Now, I've seen this firsthand. The end result is it reduces consumer choice. Basically, that new thing never happens. You never see it on the shelf. Importantly, this can impact new services as well. Let me give you an example. Let's say you have a wireless sensor used to monitor a consumer's electricity. We call it a smart meter. This requires you to license these SEPs to build the smart meter. Now, there's a good chance you'll be forced to take a license from a SEP holder at a rate that's not fair or reasonable. This extra cost that you're paying for the use of those SEPs will be passed on to the consumer in the form of a higher electricity billing rate. And Stacey, that's just not fair. This simple example is why a transparent, fair licensing system for SEPs is so necessary. It benefits everyone from the patent owner to the end user.
That's a great example. So where can we find out more information about Save Our Standards?
Save Our Standards has great information, particularly useful for small and medium businesses on SEPs, licensing issues, and even policy changes. You can find all of this information by visiting www.saveourstandards.com.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Doug Stovall, who is the CEO at ASSIA. Hello, Doug. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Excellent. So I'm excited to talk to you because we are going to talk about wireless power, which always feels
just over the horizon. And I'm not talking about induction power, which requires us to have something on top of something, or even wireless power that still requires your device to be super close to a charging plate. So we're going to talk about what ASSIA offers, and we're going to talk about how we might see it soon in the smart home. So, Doug, why don't you tell us a little bit about the technology that ASSIA is offering?
Yes, happy to do that. So CODA, as you pointed out, which is our product, allows us to safely send power over distance. And when we say distance, we're talking about up to 10 meters is the practical limit of delivery, although our regulatory approvals allow us to send it unlimited distance. And so when you think about the way this works, it works really like Wi-Fi works, where you have a transmitter that sends data and a receiver that receives the data. In our case, our power transmitter is sending power through the air. That power all lands on the receiver and powers the device. Now, the interesting thing about CODA, which is actually a patented technology, and it's patented around a physics phenomenon called retrodirectivity, and because we're using retrodirectivity, it allows us to take advantage of the benefits of physics, which means we can power devices on the move and non-line of sight. We've received regulatory approval in over 60 countries, so that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, just this month you got FCC approval for it, as you mentioned. So that is great. We'll talk about the technology in a little bit. But first, I want to paint a picture for people, because y'all actually have a deal with a company. It's a French company called Arcos. And they're talking about putting CODA in smart home products, including wearables, I feel like fans, air purifiers, something. So why don't you talk a little bit about what they're going to do and when we might see that?
Yes, happy to do that. So Arcos is a company that's based in France, headquartered actually in Paris. They've been around a number of years. You actually may know them. They actually, before there was an iPod, they had an iPod that played music, you know. And so they've been around a while. They announced with us at CES that they are going to bring four products to market. Those products are an indoor wireless camera, air quality and temperature station, a smart tracker, and a smart health watch. The camera is the first on the list to hit the market, and their goal is to have that completed and announced at CES of this year. So 1 year from the official announcement, the release would happen, and it would actually be being sold before that for the Christmas holidays is their vision. The other products they will be releasing in 2023 in a stair-stepped manner. All of those products are consumer-based products. The camera will be an event-driven device, as most cameras are nowadays. What that means is it operates much like your doorbell camera or the cameras in maybe your kid's room or things like that. They don't run all the time. They run based on certain events occurring.
So let's talk about how this works. You've got the special CODA chip that goes in the device, and then somewhere in the home there is a charging panel, yes?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So walk me through, if I am a homeowner and I want to have CODA wireless power in my home, what will my home look like? How many devices can I support? Realistically, what are my pros and cons here?
Yeah, great question. So I guess the first way that we typically describe this to our customers that are coming on board is if your home, let's say, has three Wi-Fi hubs in it, and you use three hubs, for example, to connect different parts of your house. Maybe you have one in the garage, you know, one in your living room, and one upstairs. You would start off probably having three CODA transmitters, because remember, we work on RF just like Wi-Fi, and we operate in the same bands, either 2.4 gigahertz or 5.8 gigahertz, which are the unlicensed bands. So we're a bit different than Wi-Fi in that where it becomes unique, you may need to add more transmitters than Wi-Fi, is it depends on how many devices you have to be powered in your house. Now, a number that we frequently talk about is if you look at many of the standard homes, you could have 50 to 150 devices in your home that could utilize wireless power. And think of these such as the cameras I've talked about already, the wearables, your phone, your alarm sensors on the windows, the batteries in your devices. And depending on how many devices you have, that could increase the number of transmitters you have in your house. And then the next question you're probably going to ask is, well, wait a second, how do you determine how many devices? And that part is, we actually have a tool set that shows how much power we're distributing and then how much power your various devices are consuming. And the beautiful part about it for us is our software helps manage all of that.
Got it. Okay. So then becomes the question, how much power can you distribute over this? And do we probably, because most of us are not familiar with, you know, watts, amps, volts, et cetera, that doesn't translate to anything. Let's think about in terms of time to charge specific devices. What does that look like from the device perspective?
So we talked about that in a couple of different ways. And you're right, the watts thing, a lot of people, it's hard to wrap their minds around. Heck, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around that. But ultimately, what in this particular regulatory approval, we can send 5 watts of power from the transmitter to devices. Now, what does that really mean? And one thing you asked, and you asked the question that everyone asked, well, how fast does that really mean things charge? And the fact is, we charge slower than a wire does. And as you know, induction charges slower than a wire, and we charge slower than induction. But if you want a real life example, if you've ever been on an airplane and you could plug a device into the back of an airplane seat, we charge at about that same pace. But here's the beauty of CODA. Charging time does not matter anymore. And the reason for that is this. If your devices are in your home and they're receiving power 24/7, then you don't really care how fast they charge anymore because they're always getting power. And the fact is, a device only needs 1% to charge as long as you always have 1%. And that's another thing that our product does. Our software also manages the power levels of all devices. So we charge devices when they need to be charged, therefore increasing the battery life on a device. But we also charge devices that need the most power. So for example, if your phone had a CODA chip in it and you left your house and you came back and your phone was low power, we would recognize it was low power and we wouldn't send power to any of the other devices in the house. Of course, they would already be charged. Their batteries would be charged. We would send all the power to the phone. And so therefore, from your perspective, it's not fast or slow. It's an always charged solution. And that's where the paradigm that we're working in changes.
Got it. And that makes a ton of sense. It's like when I plug my electric vehicle in at night, I'm not really worried about supercharging in my own driveway. I'm just like, let's see what happens. And I think we're actually moving to an era where our homes will become much smarter about managing energy distribution in the home, simply because we can't add a lot more power, but we're definitely adding more devices that use power. But let's get a little further in here. So the big challenge for wireless power historically has been like, hey, if you send too much power over the air, you're going to fry the people in the middle, right? It's people are concerned about their health. And there's also efficiency, like in terms of waste, like if you're sending 5 watts through the air, but only 1 watt ends up as usable work on a device, is that really the best use of our energy that we're bringing in? So can you talk about the efficiency of what you're offering? And I'm going to assume since the FCC approved it, you don't cook people.
Yeah. Well, I was going to hit the cooking one first, and you're correct. The FCC did approve it. So therefore, we've gone through that testing. We fall under Part 18 there. And what that means is we are approved under the same regulatory framework that mobile devices and Wi-Fi is. And that is ensured that we don't fry people. On the other part of your question, on the efficiency piece, we think of efficiency really in two buckets. Let's talk about bucket number one, which is efficiency compared to batteries. And when we think of efficiency, we think of end-to-end efficiency, not just the exact battery. We think of the mining of the materials to get the battery out of the earth. We think of the actual changing of the battery, the life expectancy of a battery, and then ultimately the battery being disposed of. And in every case, in every stage of that, CODA is thousands of times, and I said thousands of times, more efficient than batteries. I mean, overall, and I think the world has come to this conclusion, batteries are bad. And so in that segment, we do a very good job of having a very strong business case. And in fact, Morningstar recently put out a report on us talking about our environmental impact, and specifically as it relates to batteries. On a per year basis, ASSIA eliminates between 238,000 and 476,000 standard containers. A standard container is about 40 feet of battery waste. That's 3,600 miles of hazardous waste a year that we eliminate as companies implement COTA and deploy it. Now, this is out 3 years once we start reaching scale. So I want to stress that. But additionally, we're saving between 936 million and 1.8 billion liters of water. That's 760 Olympic-sized swimming pools. And we're also avoiding between 468 and 936 tons of lithium being mined. So from that perspective, from efficiency, from sustainability against batteries, our impact is staggering. Against wires, when you look at efficiency, where wires from the socket to the device, a wire is more efficient than us. In general, wires are about 50%, give or take, efficient. We run somewhere between 8 and 12% of efficiency, depending on the use case, the size of the transmitter, and where you are. So we're less efficient. But when you look at the cost of running wires, and when you think about IoT, which is your sweet spot, obviously, one of the big untruths about IoT is when people go out and they say, you know, we're going to have billions or trillions of IoT devices. The fact is, mankind has never built a trillion batteries and we've never run a trillion wires. It's just impossible. And so ultimately, you have to have wireless power. And so the question becomes efficiency or lack of efficiency, but does the use case overpowered? And in the long run, is it the correct thing to do? And that's what the use case has to drive.
Okay. And the reason I'm interested in wireless power is not actually for the home. Although, you know, if I never have to take off my Fitbit to charge it again, that'd be great. Or, you know, recharge my doorbell camera. You know, those kind of things are kind of irritating. But I think in the industrial and enterprise settings, when I think about sprinkling, again, like you said, trillions of sensors everywhere, we can't do it with batteries. We have to have, and my focus is on energy harvesting because that feels a little bit more here and now. I'm happy to have wireless power, although if I'm thinking about in a smart city perspective, I'm not sure where the panels would be or how that would work. But so I'm with you. We definitely have to do something that isn't battery based. You're very right. And wires, while great, don't work for everything. So let's get into a little bit more fun because there are existing standards. There's the Qi standard. They've got one, actually the same organization is pushing one for the kitchen to power a higher wattage device like blenders or stand mixers or toasters, anything that, you know, needs a lot of power really fast. And how do you envision, take me 10 years in the future maybe when I have like a Qi thing built underneath my kitchen counter. Maybe I've got energy harvesting sensors for my light switches. I don't know. What does that look like from your perspective?
Yeah, I think all of that works together. So the world we see is that you will have Qi at low level and higher level powers. But then also we think there's a home for energy harvesting. As you know, that those tend to be very low, what we call low power. And our sweet spot, really, think of us living in the cell phone power levels down to hundreds of milliwatts. So we live above the energy harvesting level. And if you think about it, there are lots of devices in that segment. And so we see a home or an office or a business, industrial or not, with all three of these existing. As a matter of fact, just this year at CES, we announced a table that has induction-based charging in the tabletop. We are mounted in the ceiling. We have a transmitter in the ceiling that is powering the table, which has a battery in it that you power the table, and then it charges any device, any induction-based device you sit on top of the table. The benefit is this table, if it's deployed at a coffee shop or in an airport or in a mall, never has to be plugged in. You can move it wherever you want to, and power will always get to it. That's an example of Qi and COTA coexisting, and we see that being a very typical model in the future.
All right. And then let's talk about some of the other over-the-air wireless charging options.
So PowerCast, they actually live in a different frequency. We do 920 megahertz. And so that's lower than us. They actually send much lower power than we do. So they do transmit power, but it's a lot less. And so we do think there's a home. We just feel like there's so much work out there and so much opportunity that there's a great place for them and a great place for us. We are widely considered to be the only company in the world that can deliver power at the power levels we do and at the distance we do successfully. We have 185 granted patents around this and 250 patents pending. So all of the stuff we do is IP protected and has been validated through our customers signing up and starting to build products.
Okay, so let's play a fun game where I'm going to throw out a device and you can tell me what the right wireless charging power mechanism might be. Does this sound fun?
That sounds fantastic, to be honest. I've never played this game, but I'm looking forward to it.
I developed it just for you, Doug. All right. So we'll start off easy. Let's say my smartwatch.
Coda. No question, no doubt. There's no other option. And it's because of what you said earlier. You don't want to take your watch off every night. What if you never had to think about taking your watch off?
That's true. I don't mind setting my phone in a specific place to charge it overnight. But my wearables, I'm like, ugh. Dang it, I'm missing valuable sleep tracking information.
That's exactly the problem. And, I love my Fitbit because I like to know how much I've slept. But if I have to charge it every day, it's annoying.
Okay. My electric vehicle.
Not Coda. In my opinion, the best company for that is a company called Y-Charge out of Boston. They're already working with Hyundai. And they can power. That's electric vehicle is much, much more power than we can ever. Now, you may look at our customers and say, but Doug, you work with Toyota Group. How? Toyota has many companies, both automotive and non-automotive, but in their automotive organization, we charge the devices inside the car.
Got it. All right. Let's see. My connected toaster oven.
Not Coda. And that would be one that would be some sort of, as you mentioned, induction-based charging counter embedded.
They call it Qi, if you're curious. Qi has developed Qi.
To be honest, and I'm a wireless power guy, I did not even know that. So
it's very specific for the kitchen, although I'm excited because, I like cooking. All right. My connected door lock.
Coda. No question. And we, as a matter of fact, have use cases with customers in development for that. Between connected locks and the doorbells with camera, those actually are rapidly evolving to some of the largest IoT deployments in the world, just from in terms of overall volumes of if you add all the players in the space, and you I'm sure know this. And so the great news there is you may have 1, 2, 3 of those in your house. And so that's great as well.
My smart speaker that stays constantly on my kitchen counter.
Great question. That could be a couple. It could be Coda, and it would be if it has a battery in it and you're leaving the battery in it, Coda could power that and you'd be in great shape. Or you could use induction charging, or you could use both. So that could go two different ways.
I thought you'd just say, just keep that plugged in. It doesn't move anywhere.
The problem is they don't ever not move anywhere. You say that, but think about your speaker or my speaker in the house. Inevitably, one of my kids is trying to grab it, and really, if it wasn't plugged in, don't you think you'd move it more often?
All right. I feel like that was a pretty successful game. You've already mentioned sensors, or I was going to throw out my leak detection sensors, but I bet your answer's Coda.
No, that's an easy one. But I'll go back to the speaker. I didn't really realize that we had another option plugged in, but that could also be one you could leave plugged in. So I would say that, yeah.
I was just throwing it out there just to see what your thoughts were. Are we getting rid of all wires or not?
No. And we would never say that. Here's the problem, really, with wired devices. And honestly, we've learned this at ASSIA. Devices that you plug in are not built to be energy friendly. And they're actually very, very inefficient. Battery powered devices are much more efficient. And Coda built devices are even more efficient because you're building the device with efficiency in mind. And it's one of the things you said earlier, and I thought this is where you were going, when you talked about that you look at the typical house and there's so many devices, we've got to get more efficient. One of the biggest problems we have is anything you're plugging in is not efficient. If all of those had certain efficiency standards, we'd be a lot better off. COTA will help drive that efficiency. Well, all of wireless power will help drive that efficiency.
I agree. I think as we add more connectivity, more smarts to things, we'll definitely see efficiency gains, even though we're probably going to be using more power overall. All right. Well, Doug, thank you for sharing what's going on at ASSIA. And I look forward to 2023 when it can start trying some of these devices out.
Well, we do too. I mean, we kind of feel like wireless power has been a thing that's been coming for a long time. And the great news with these regulatory approvals is it's finally here. And so now's the time to get some products in people's hands.
And that concludes this week's episode of the Internet of Things podcast. Please join us next Thursday, and don't forget to subscribe. And if you can't get enough IoT news, I would love for you to sign up at www.stacyonIoT.com for our weekly IoT newsletter, where we explain all kinds of things that we don't even get to on the show. Once again, thank you for listening, and please subscribe.